And you should go and start talking.
All right. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning in once again to the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today, we're talking about Logan and Iron Fist because those are the two big cool things in superhero media right now. And have a large panel of folks here to talk about it. Aid Smith, thanks for showing up, Aid.
Hello.
Jacob Blackman. Jacob, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Chandro, thanks for coming.
Always a pleasure.
And we have Marion Harmon, who is the author of Wearing the Cape, the series of novels, as well as the recent Fate-based RPG. Unfortunately, Marion's having some audio problems. So, Marion, just please pipe up whenever you get your microphone working. And I'm afraid we can't hear you right now. I see your mouth moving, but I can't hear you, sir. I'm sorry. I know it's frustrating. And Walt Rebillard is running the podcast. How you doing, Walt?
Hello, and unlike Finn Jones, I can actually do kung fu.
Is that your way of saying you weren't incredibly impressed with the Iron Fist?
The fight choreography was lackluster, although I really did enjoy the series.
Okay, yeah, I've heard that complaint from lots of people about the fight choreography. Well, you're a martial artist yourself. How could they have improved it?
They should have started Finn earlier, or gave him some kung fu to do that would have been more rudimentary and less flashy. Even though Iron Fist is supposed to be flashy when he does do his martial arts, Finn Jones obviously wasn't trained for it, or trained to the level that we would have expected. Because I was good with the amount of fight scenes in the show. But like I said, the fight choreography itself was very, very simple. Toward the end of the episodes, they started doing cutaways so that they could show a little more skill. It was kind of difficult to watch. I mean, if I had to judge, just to give the audience some context, I'm 45 now. I've been doing martial arts since I was 8. And the ability that I saw on screen was very similar to somebody who had gotten 3 months of training, you know, 3 months of good training, but 3 months of training nonetheless. But I do think that the greatest line in the entire series was, "Please stop disgracing my katana with your wushu bullshit."
I love that scene. That was great.
That was delightful. Yes.
You know, because even though, many styles of wushu and kung fu have saber style weapons. The katana sword is not balanced and made for what he was doing with it. And it was just funny to see her say, "Hey, cut that out. You're hurting my soul."
Well, what I liked about that scene and following ones was that it embraced the idea of multiple styles and us seeing these different styles in conflict. Like, yeah, there's a scene later on where Colleen fights somebody using that wushu bullshit. She fights another female fighter, like one of the guards at Madame Gao's base or something. And that's this big sort of sword fight duel between the wushu bullshit and her bushido, you know? And I totally hear what you're saying, Walt. I'm not a kung fu expert, a martial arts expert. I heard a lot of people echoing your critique. A good friend of mine, Warren Belfield, who's done a bunch of pro wrestling, had the same critique about the fight choreography. He called himself a fight choreography snob. And I told him, well, if you haven't earned that right by being punched in the head all those times, I don't know who has earned it, you know? But I enjoyed the show. And I'm glad I noticed your critique about that. You thought that it's not that there weren't enough fight scenes, because I heard that from a lot of critics before the show broadcast, that they just wanted more fighting. But that wasn't your complaint. Your complaint was not the number, but the quality.
The quality, you know, and even little things like when you look at the sign on Colleen Wing's place, the yep. Chakara Dojo, right? Yep. There's a series of martial arts that she lists on that sign.
Yep.
And one of them is Kenpo, right? Yeah. So when you hear that term in English, a lot of people have they get all fancy when they start translating languages because everybody wants to be exotic.
Right.
The basic understanding of that term, right? It comes from two ideograms that mean fist or punching, and the other one means way or method. So you know, everybody will always put their spin on, oh, the way of the fist. No. Just think boxing, okay?
Yeah.
Japanese boxing or Chinese boxing. And there's a when you do Kenpo, there's a myriad of technique that can be trained in with this.
Yeah.
And you get a good syllabus in the beginning, even in your beginning stages of training.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there in one of the scenes, and he's like, okay, well, this is a leopard's paw.
Yeah.
Right. And this is how you use it, blah, blah, blah. Now, if she's got a Kenpo thing on her sign, that she knows how to do that.
Yeah. You
know? So, I mean, unless she's just putting words up on the sign to bring in students, which I doubt, you know, that that's what they were going for. She would know how to do that. And it's little things like that, you know, it's just like when and I talk about this with Dominic Sumner all the time.
Yeah.
When I watch a movie like John Wick or something like that.
Yeah.
John Wick, brilliantly executed, right? In many things. And one of the best things is the way that ammunition is treated. When you got a rifle that runs out of ammunition, if you pull that trigger does not continue to click. And it's the same thing when she was showing off that kung fu skill.
Yep.
She, as a Kenpo stylist, would have had those. So it's those little things that I was good with the quantity of the fights. I think that the fights were put in to really accent the story, which is more about trauma of these two families.
Yes.
But the quality was very lackluster. I could see what they were going for, but you could tell that they just didn't hit the mark. And I think we got Marion, who has sound now.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Hey. We can.
Hello.
All right. We're on.
And you're doing kung fu in the back.
Well, hey, just to reacquaint our listeners who might have short attention spans, this is Marion Harmon. He is the author of the series of novels Wearing the Cape, and he's also recently had a successful Kickstarter for an RPG of the same name, Fate Based Supers, and he's gracing up with his presence today. Thanks for coming out, sir.
Thank you. It's a good conversation so far.
Marion, forgive me for asking a really dumb question, but will you tell me about your novel series? I teach superhero as genre at the university level, and I'm very interested in your books.
Well, I basically just took the action adventure genre and tried to transplant a realistic superhero universe on top of that.
I see. Yeah.
So I haven't set out so much to tell superhero stories as to tell stories about people who are superheroes. Distinction, but I think a pretty important one.
Yeah.
Okay. So we get more stories about paying the mortgage while trying to wear the mask, stuff like that.
Dealing with the media, learning how to actually be a functional hero in a system where you're not just a vigilante running around in a mask and the law kind of ignores you.
Yeah.
So it has its fights. It has a lot of fights. It's got all that usual action stuff. But it tries to set it in a socially and legally realistic worldview, I guess.
No.
So it's
this
kind of, much, much different than the old Marvel stuff.
This kind of reminds me of the initial premise behind Astro City, that we were going to cover all of the stuff about being a superhero other than the fight scenes.
Yes. Yeah. Although the fights have got to be there, of course. But yes, Astro City was a big influence on me.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
Now here's a question I have for taking the superhero genre and bringing it into more a mundane view in terms of how they addressed by the law, you know, what collateral damage would actually do and stuff like that. How do you address in superhero fiction that is going for a more grounded feel? How do you address violence? I live just outside of a big city. There are cameras everywhere. And now some of the police departments are actually fielding drones and drone technology. How do you run into a phone booth and, you know, pull your underwear out when you're being watched all the time without giving away your secret identity? Or do you even have secret identities anymore?
Well, in my setting, the secret identities are actually fairly rare. Most superheroes don't bother with them. For one thing, they are very hard to maintain. For another, of course, it's hell on your social life to try and have anything remotely resembling balance that way. There are some that have secret identities, but the only ones that really do are with the permission, approval, and help of the government. So sort of, remember The Incredibles, the movie?
Yep.
Where the government itself was actually behind helping you to maintain a private identity.
Yeah.
So they knew who you were. Nobody else needed to know.
So Jack Bauer's secret is safe.
Yes. And I even had a context where you might have someone who had a public outing as far as his powers appearing. He decides he wants to be a hero but protect his family, so the government actually helps him set up a private identity, like witness protection. So you could have multiple layers, but the main character starts out with a secret identity, helped by the government, but she gets out around book 3 or 4.
Marian, do you know the book The Law of Superheroes by James Daly and Ryan Davidson? They have a blog called Law and the Multiverse. Does that sound familiar to you?
Nope.
I'm just curious what you thought of it.
I don't know. Can you hear?
I'm familiar with it. It was an inspiration for my book also. I highly recommend it to anyone who wants to deal with superhero realism.
Oh, okay. So you have that. You give that book your seal of approval.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I really enjoyed how they took on Marvel and DC and talked about a lot of the aspects of what they do from that legal standpoint.
Okay. Good. I asked that because I'm not as familiar with the law, and so I'm sort of looking to you for an expert endorsement. So I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a really interesting book. I read it, but I wasn't quite sure how much credit to give it. So that's good. Thank you.
And Marian, have you seen any episodes of Iron Fist?
I heard you talking about that, and yes, I've seen the first 3 episodes. I agree with you 100% on the choreography problem, by the way. It would have looked good to somebody 20 years ago who didn't know any better to what Hollywood does these days. But yeah, I hope they pick up the pace on that.
Well, in episode 4, the hatchet-wielding triad shows up, and that's basically what sold me.
Yeah, the hallway fight with the triad followed by the elevator fight immediately after that was a pretty decent scene. But
I like the elevator fight a lot.
Yeah.
But they had better choreography in Daredevil.
Yeah.
They had great choreography in Daredevil. How could they do that and then do this then?
Someone said it was rushed. Someone said the production was rushed and that was the problem, because I believe Finn Jones has also said on Twitter or somewhere that it was literally practicing the fight 15 minutes before he was due to film it. So they were saying it was like, okay, we need to get this done. We need to get it completed. We've got X amount of days to do it. Let's just get it done. We'll get it on the screen. Done. Yeah, for me personally, it looked okay. You can see that it's not quite as fluid as it should be. I can't tell you about, obviously, Walt would pick up the more particulars that, yeah, the stances may be off or something like that. But when you see like the punches thrown or when blocks go in, you can see, okay, that person is just in the right position, kind of like watching wrestling, where you go, oh, he's going to get hit on the head. Oh, we're lucky enough, he's got his hands up just as he's about to be smashed on the face. It's kind of reminding me of that. But all in all, I've just watched the last episode today, and all in all, pretty damn good all the way through. And like you said, it's nice to see, rather than just tar every single martial arts or, you know, a Japanese, Chinese, all in the same thing and just go, yeah, it's all just martial arts. It's nice to see there's actually a differential between them all. So.
I could not help but laugh when the Drunken Master showed up.
Yeah.
I love that fight scene. I thought that was brilliant.
Have you ever seen real drunken kung fu?
Only if Jackie Chan movie counts.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty much where I've seen it too.
Yeah, it's actually very fluid. Well, I'm sorry, Marian, what was that?
I just said it sounds like I have a lot to look forward to in that series. Yeah.
That scene was that system was pretty faithfully recreated. It's very interesting that. You know, they found somebody who could do that kind of fight choreography and then couldn't translate that to the actual actor.
Yeah, I have to imagine they basically hired an actor like for his drunken master kung fu. I mean, talk about a niche skill, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very, very rare system. That and stuff like Bak Mei Pai, which is white eyebrow kung fu, which they showed off a little bit in the series. A little bit of Hungar, which is very, very powerful type kung fu. There were several.
Are you just making up words now?
No, you know what? I recognize all of these from Ninja Hero.
Nice.
So what system is Iron Fist supposed to be using exactly?
I thought it was supposed to be Shaolin Kung Fu.
Yeah, my understanding for the series, they were going for Shaolin Five Animal Kung Fu.
Yeah.
Which would explain when he goes into when you see his hands parry out with the thumbs forward and the fingers closed.
Yeah.
Tiger. When you see his hands basically in a triangle, but with his pointed at the forearm, and then this hand canted this way. Snake. Yeah. But there were other influences as well that you could see that they were going for. And if you knew what to look for, you could say, "Oh my God, I can see what he's doing." The real standout in the series, and a couple of the guys on the show sound like they haven't seen the whole series, so I'm not going to spoil the whole thing.
Sure.
But somebody who shows up at the end and is like, kind of like Mordo is in Doctor Strange. His kung fu skill was amazing. I was good. Like, wow, that guy could fight.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was good. What did you guys think of the relationships between all the characters? I mean, this very broken family. Kung Fu aside, what did you think of the actual story of the show?
It's Shakespearean. The dynamics that are very interesting.
I have to confess that I could basically just watch Colleen Wing for an hour. she could be sitting there drinking a cappuccino and I would not complain. But what I really like, a lot of the complaints about the show were about the beginning episodes where a lot of critics felt it was very slow. But when Danny shows up and he has to try to convince everybody that he is who he is, I liked it because it was a contrast to the Batman Begins kind of Bruce Wayne returns to New York, returns to Gotham. And that happened so quickly and so instantly. And so I thought that they were using the unique abilities of a television show to intentionally kind of drag that out and explore it a little bit in a way that you couldn't do if you were watching a two-hour and a half film. I liked it. And the people playing the Meachums, initially, I didn't really worry about them very much. They didn't strike. They were just sort of stereotypical bad guys, you know. But as the show went on, I really kind of came to admire the actor playing Ward Meacham.
Oh yeah,
he does amazing work in that show, and his character has a real arc. And I shouldn't have been surprised because the best thing about Iron Fist, I mean, about one of the great things about Luke Cage. Was the arc between the brother and sister, Cottonmouth and his sister, watching that develop. So I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was.
I think this is better. I watched the first three episodes all in one straight line and didn't think they dragged at all. I thought it was
good.
This quick. And like I said before, with Luke Cage, I got to about episode 6, episode 7. I kind of forced myself to watch 8, and then kind of, there's 3 or more. I might as well watch a lot. This I've watched in the space of a week, and I've watched easily 2 at a time every time they've gone through. There's never been a bit where, oh god, here they come, they're talking, these people are talking, get them off the screen. See more conflict. There's never been that. Each character seems to be quite interesting. There's not like a lame duck character that's like, okay, we don't need that B story, that should be removed. They could have stripped stuff down. They could have made it a shorter series, but what they had was fine. They could have taken a few points out, but I didn't think it dragged. I didn't think there was any problem in that respect.
No, this is the
Office. I had more trouble watching Westworld than I did watching this.
Oh, interesting. Good.
So
the critique with Netflix has generally been that they have kind of a mid-season drag. But I definitely agree with you that Iron Fist doesn't have that. I mean, it takes this left turn around episode 7 or 8 into the ninja school, like the kung fu martial arts school. That a couple of you guys haven't finished it, so I don't want to, ruin it too much, but I will. and it kind of goes. We get the ninja school for a while, but I agree with you, Aid. I thought that it kept its tempo pretty quick, and once things heated up, it stayed hot.
Yeah, because I remember Luke Cage. There was the bit where when he got shot and he was on the run, and it seemed like there was an episode where he basically did nothing apart from being on the run, and then he came back and attacked the club at the end. And you think you could have done that an episode ago, and you wouldn't have had just that null episode where nothing much happened.
Yeah,
and this didn't seem to do that.
Yeah, and he gets shot again at the end of the episode. And you're like, okay, so at the end of two episodes in a row is just Luke Cage getting shot. And you're like, okay, like that's just lazy.
Well, as a writer, I've got no complaints about the pacing.
Good.
And I really like the way they've been developing the family relationship with the daughter who loves the company, the son who despises it but can't walk away. It's really well done.
Yeah, good.
Yeah,
Jacob,
we've
been talking over you.
No problem. I'm always patient to wait my turn. But one of the things I have to say about the pacing is, I think people have forgotten how slow season one of Daredevil was. I mean, you looking back on it, you can say, oh yeah, it was great and it was amazing, but it was slow as hell.
I'm not forgetting because I never finished it.
And now, honestly, in comparison, Iron Fist is pretty much going at the same pace as first season of Daredevil. It's just one of the differences. Iron Fist isn't as well as well known a character as Daredevil. A lot of people can know who Daredevil is, but really, when it comes to Iron Fist, he's one of those really low tier heroes in Marvel. As his own series, he really didn't come into his own until he joined up with Luke Cage for Heroes for Hire.
Right.
And
don't forget Fractions run too.
Yeah, and honestly, the guy really never had a story of his own. It was pretty much the classic martial arts revenge story that occupied his series first run. And he had a villain that was basically a clone version of him, and that was it. There's nothing to Iron Fist.
This is where I make my obligatory note that the first appearance of Sabretooth is as an Iron Fist villain.
Yes,
that's true. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Forgot about that.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Jacob. And I actually, this is what I like about the Netflix shows, is I actually kind of like their slow pacing. Whether you think that it's slow or not, I like it because I feel like it's designed to be binge watched, where you can take 10 minutes. I remember in the first Daredevil series, there's this scene where Karen is talking to this old woman in Spanish for about 10 minutes, and it's all And a network television show would never allow that to happen because it'll lose you. Like you'll switch channels. You won't stick with it for 10 minutes of that. But a Netflix show has more confidence. Like, well, you're here to binge watch. You're already 4 hours in. You're not going to quit now. And it explores things a little bit more slowly. And so I enjoy that. I like it when they do that.
But the thing is, the slow pace, like you said, I enjoy it myself because Marvel has always been about the character interactions. Even though superheroes in general are about the fights and the combat and everything and showing off their powers, it's really always been about, even more than DC, the interpersonal relationships of the characters. You see a lot more interaction with heroes and non-heroes in Marvel than you do in DC. Most people in DC, when they're interacting with other people, they're interacting with other heroes.
Yeah. In Daredevil, Foggy Nelson made that show. Like, the actor that they cast as Foggy, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And a similar thing happens with Patsy Walker in Jessica Jones. And Colleen Wing carries that load in Iron Fist. And I think they do an amazing job with the supporting cast.
I think they need to take the supporting cast, put Night Nurse in the lead, and just have a Night Nurse series. I would watch the shit out of that. That would be amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Night Nurse, Colleen Wing, and, you know,
Patsy Walker.
Patsy Walker, Misty Knight, just get all of them. Yes. And
Foggy Nelson acting as their agent.
Foggy is their Charlie. Bosley, right? He's like their Bosley.
Oh, my God, that would be amazing.
This series now, when are they bringing all these characters together?
Defenders just finished filming.
That's right.
Last week.
And it is supposed to be the next series in line. So we should have it within the next 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, they're probably doing all the special effects and post.
No, we don't know the story. We know that who's it? Who's the actress playing the bad guy? I can't believe I've forgotten her name.
You mean Madame Gao?
No, Sigourney Weaver is
Sigourney Weaver,
Defenders, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We don't know who she's playing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
From the voiceovers that we've heard of the teasers, we've heard a lot of voiceovers from Stick.
Yeah.
In the Defenders teaser, so I'm imagining it's going to continue somewhat with the story, with the overall story of the Hands' attempted takeover of New York City.
Well, we have to remember that there literally is a giant plot hole in Daredevil's second season.
Yeah, what is that giant hole that goes into the middle of the Earth?
Yeah, which we discover and then never talk about again. So it's this giant plot hole, and presumably that's where
we're literal going. Hole. Okay,
yeah, it's a literal hole. Yeah.
You know what? I got $20 of this Fin Fang Foom. What's that action?
I wish you are right, but I will
totally be cool.
Take that back if you are so wrong.
Well, they are doing monsters purple pants, though.
He has to be wearing his little purple pants, otherwise Fin Fang Foom's not worth doing.
Actually, if you go back to Iron Man 3 with the white guy, the bad guy in that movie, he's got the dragon tattoos and he breathes fire and he's the guy that created the Mandarin. He is Fin Fang Foom in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
No, I did not catch that.
Yeah.
Damn.
Okay. Hey, people were calling this the first big stumble for Marvel TV, but I was going to suggest that the second season of Agent Carter was not that good.
It was okay. I mean, it wasn't excellent.
It wasn't as good as first season of Agent Carter.
Right.
I have to blame that on the fact that it was nothing but the overall arcing plot. They didn't do any little setup here and there and little one shots to get her started like they did with first season. They just jumped into the meta plot and stayed with the meta plot the entire time.
Well, the critique about Iron Fist had very little to do with the stuff we've been talking about and everything to do with the whitewashing of Asian culture. Let's examine this. Like, okay, so Iron Fist is a 70s character. He's a product of the American ninja sort of era, and he's a classic example of a white dude who can do everything Asian better than Asians. And this builds a lot of problems now in a 21st century audience. And a lot of the most of the outspoken critics of Iron Fist have taken the show to task for that they should have recast Danny Rand as Asian and not made the white guy who's better at kung fu than all the Asians.
In preference, I would have rather have watched a Shang-Chi series.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, my thoughts on that was that, well, like, you can recast Danny as Asian, but then he's not Iron Fist anymore. His story is the story of the white dude in China. And if you change him, then yeah, exactly. It's Shang-Chi now. It's not Iron Fist. It's just Shang-Chi.
Well, you know, I've been catching up. I'm sorry, Marion, go ahead.
I'm just going to say it's the same problem they have with Doctor Strange, of course. And white guy goes to Asia, learns Asian mysticism, comes back, and he's a world protector. Yeah. So it's something they can't get away from, really, without changing the characters to a great degree.
If that's the case, though, we should just have the two series. We should have an Iron Fist and a Shang-Chi, because look at martial arts in America today. All of these martial arts that have come to America and all of these people who teach these martial arts are products mostly of American soldiers going over to these countries and then coming back and bringing it back. I know myself, I spent copious amounts of time, years at a time in other countries, learning martial arts and then bringing it back. And, you know, I'm not a superhero. I'm not saving the world.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, we do have people from other cultures. When I was training overseas, we had a huge, huge flock of British students, a bunch of people from Turkey, you know, and everybody had to learn the language. Everybody had to conform to how those people live their lives. Yeah. And, you know, we so that kind of thing happens, but that also leaves room, I mean, for something like having a Shang-Chi series so that you can show both sides of the coin. You can show people like Fumio Demura, who's a very famous karate expert, who really wanted to bring his passion for that martial art to the United States. And, you know, even in his 80s and 90s now, he has continued that passion. So we can have both side by side, and even what a great series it would be to have somebody like Shang-Chi and Iron Fist working in concert.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've been reading the Brubaker run on Iron Fist, and Jason, thanks for recommending that.
My pleasure.
If you read that, I mean, they go through kind of the whole, they have flashbacks showing different Iron Fist throughout history.
The best series ever, that is. It's so good.
Most of whom are Asian. So that's something that would be a fertile field, you know. But, you know, who knows what they're going to do after Defenders. So
I would love to see flashback episodes of previous Iron Fists. I would love that. And it would address a lot of this criticism, this sort of culture warfare criticism that the show's been getting.
Didn't Madame Gao mention other Iron Fists?
Yes, she said she didn't think she would meet another one.
Yeah.
Well, there are other Iron Fists. Steel Serpent is an Iron Fist. And he's the classic Iron Fist villain.
Yeah, in the show, he's not Iron Fist. He's in training to be Iron Fist, but he didn't get it.
But also, the thing is that even though, Danny Rand has the power, but his martial arts aren't particularly better than anybody else's,
Well, and that's one of the...
Colin Wing could take him in a fight if he didn't use his Iron Fist. So it's not as though it's like, I can destroy everybody that I ever face. He still gets beaten, and or at least knocked back.
Yeah.
You can say, it's cultural appropriation. So that we're not saying that, hey, he's better than everybody. It's just the guy happened to be there and got the power.
I think it's around episode 8 that we see a movie reel from the 1940s, and we see Chinese soldiers trying to break into Kunlun. And they're repelled by an Iron Fist, and we get him on film, and he's got two Iron Fists, right? Like both of his fists are going, and Danny's like, "Holy shit! How does he do that?" Right? And we quickly realize that Iron Fist's training kind of stopped at, okay, you've got the Iron Fist. We'll get to the rest later, and he never got to the rest. Iron Fist does not reach his superhero identity by the end of this series. It's unlike Daredevil, and it's not like Power Man, like Luke Cage. He is still very much a superhero in training at the end of his series, which is different than all the other shows.
Well, it's also very indicative of martial art movies and shows. A proper student is always training.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I remember at the end of Daredevil where he kind of gets the suit, you know, and they talk a lot about him getting the suit. We never see Iron Fist in costume this series. The closest we get is a shot in Kunlun where he's wearing a green and yellow robe.
Well, so, you never get Luke Cage in costume either, but there's a reason for that.
Well, we do see him that once, right? That's Aid's favorite moment from the show.
Yeah, my favorite bit, which kept me watching the rest of the show, yeah.
That was great. I like that.
So, do we want to talk about Logan? Or do we have time? It's almost 2:30 here.
Snick, bub.
It's a phenomenal film. I really liked it. I thought it was super smart. It made me want to go out and listen to Johnny Cash for 24 hours. It's great.
That was the effect the trailer had on me. I haven't seen the movie yet.
But, you haven't seen it?
I got a kid. You know, I'm talking about Lego Batman. I can talk to you about Lego Batman all day.
Johnny Cash is the soundtrack to the film. That's great, the way it works out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I pretty much for the last 2 weeks, my son and I, every conversation is like, Daddy, yes, Connor. What kind of vehicle does Scarecrow have? He drives a pizza bike, Connor. Why does he drive a pizza bike, Daddy? And I got to make up a reason for a two-second scene in the movie. But for every damn Batman villain who's on screen, like, Daddy, what's up with Condiment King? Sorry. Anyway, Logan, tell me about it. What'd you guys think?
I very much enjoyed it. It was an excellent film. It would be a good cap on the X-Men movie franchise, but I know they're going to continue making X-Men movies, and they have an X-Men series coming up. But yeah,
I totally agree with you, Abe. Jacob, if this was the last X-Men movie for 10 years, it would be a perfect way to send it off. Yeah.
I enjoyed it, but I thought that it had one problem with it, and that was the rating change, because it is a different rating than the rest of the X-Men shows.
Yep.
And they played into that extremely. So it's played on a completely different level, and so it's not really something you can put on your shelf with the others and say it's part of the series in a cap. It's a very different story in a very different way.
Yeah, it certainly is a different tone. I totally agree with you. But I liked that. To me, the tone fit so well, I was willing to excuse it.
That's
well,
yes,
Shane, and it was all very well. It was Shane as an X-Men movie.
Yeah, yeah. And I teach film, so I can't wait to partner this film with Shane the next time I teach film. Yeah, I can't wait.
Well, the director did say that the Logan movie is not supposed to take place in the same X-Men universe. It's supposed to be a divergent of a what if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, but no one cares about all that.
Yeah,
shit,
but
right?
no one cares about it, but yeah. but he said it is that's what it is.
Yeah, I hear you.
Jennifer Lawrence has gone on record saying she doesn't want to be in an X-Men movie again, but she would be in Guardians of the Galaxy if they let her. So, I mean, right now that's kind of the big marquee name, unless you're bringing back Patrick Stewart for the next X-Men movie. So,
yeah.
I don't know. There's a big question mark for me next to that franchise, but, you know, one good movie could save that. So,
I'm more interested in the TV series. They've got the actor in it, and Polaris has been cast. So I'm actually kind of eager to watch the television show.
What TV show are you talking about?
Yeah, the non-Legion TV show.
I believe it's called Gifted. It's about a family of whose the kids are mutants and the parents are not, and they're basically on the run. But it's set in the X-Men universe and is tied into the films.
I have not heard about this at all.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Amy Acker plays the mom, and like I say, Polaris is a character in the show. She's been cast. I think Blink is in it.
I put Blink. I think that's
a good choice because she's a popular character.
Well, I think she is popular, and also her power is perfect for an Underground Railroad show, which is kind of what this is. It's about a bunch of, you know, like mutants on the run from Sentinels. So there's going to be Sentinels in the show. We know that, too.
What network?
Fox, unfortunately.
Fox yeah. Because they own the rights, yeah.
Oh, so we'll get like half a season. Okay, that's a bummer.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I hope they find a way to tie it all in more closely. I mean, I've really been enjoying the way the Marvel Cineverse has kept everything together and tight.
Is anybody watching Legion?
I am, yeah.
The Shadow King showed up, for Christ's sakes. I mean, that's digging, that's pretty deep.
Well, the guy who made it, it's the same guy doing the Fargo TV series. And all due respect, you know, I'm saying this as a compliment. He's a hardcore geek.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised to see those kind of nods. But I liked his previous work in Fargo, which is why I checked this out. If it had just been an X-Men TV show, I might have said meh. But it's well done. Every episode's trippy, interesting plot twists. It's what I'm watching at the gym right now, and I'm really enjoying it. So
and we saw a confirmation that he is Charles Xavier's son.
I missed that.
Yeah, yeah. It was in the last episode, like just a couple of nights ago.
Okay, well, that's probably what I haven't seen then. So yeah, cool. Yeah, I highly recommend it to everybody who asked me about it. I'm eager for it to get. Although I guess it's not tied into the movie universe. I mean, it's once again a Divergent kind of thing.
Yep.
So we're not going to see Patrick Stewart or Hugh Jackman showing up, but. But yeah, it's pretty cool. Well, hey, this is the point of the podcast where I like to awkwardly segue to talking about gaming. And Marion's here to talk about, obviously there's a novel series we can touch on, but you just had a successful Kickstarter for Wearing the Cape, the Fate-based Supers RPG. Congratulations. And now I understand from reading around that you're kind of a long-term gamer from back in the day. Was that was that what gave you the impetus to want to take your setting into an RPG setting? Because, I mean, I know there's not... You didn't do it for the fat loot, all right?
It was one of those itches you had to scratch. I mean, I picked up Dungeons & Dragons when I was 12. My father brought home the box set. He thought it was a fantasy war game, like playing the Lord of the Rings Battle of Five Armies or something. He was disappointed to find out it was something different. And he just gave it to us kids, said, "Hey, see what you can do with this." And we played D&D for 8 years after that. We did Metamorphosis Alpha, Gamma World, Top Secret, Star Frontiers. We hit virtually every single role-playing game as they came out. So yeah, when I did my role-playing, well, when I did the book series, I patterned the hero powers and stuff very much after the structures I learned in the role-playing games. So this kind of just turned it back around.
Well, you wouldn't be the first person to do that. I mean, Wild Cards started as a Chaosium superhero game.
Yes, and of course George R.R. Martin. That was his way of making his. What was it? 2 years he played that obsessively. It blew a couple of years of his author career.
Yep, that's right.
Well, there's some rumors that his RPG campaign is why Game of Thrones hasn't been a finished novel series yet. So.
Well, since he did the RPG all the way back in, 1985 or something? I don't know if you can blame it on that.
I'm hoping that he doesn't write that last book yet, because 10 years ago when Arthur Lives, I wrote a joke about Game of Thrones not being done yet, and that joke is still fucking funny.
And I guess, Mary, we should give you the context. Jason has written another a game for Fate Core, a modern-day Arthurian fantasy called Arthur Lives.
Yeah, I don't want to distract from Marion's thing, but let me ask you. So you have powers, superpowers in your game. Did you use the same superpower system from Venture City?
No, I looked at it, but when I was first putting everything together, all they had was the smaller Venture City story, and they didn't have very much detail.
Yep.
And I decided also that I wanted it loose and structured, so I had already gone through 3 rounds of playtesting before Venture City came out.
Yep.
The bigger thing. And I looked at that and went, no, that was actually too structured for what I had done.
So now, we've got two parallel super systems then in Fate.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I can't say one is better than the other. What it really depends on is what your approach is to role-playing with Fate. If you're looking for something that's closer to a structured build-up like Mutants and Masterminds or something,
Go
with Venture State. Because it is a very structured setup.
But if you want something that's maybe a little bit more freeform, where players can use their powers to do a wide variety of things that maybe aren't listed on their character sheet, go with your system.
Yes. Well, the way I set it up was I do have templates for the major powers that appear in the books.
I see.
And those are modeled through stunts. And one of the aspects that I give a Fate player in this game is a power aspect. It's one of his five aspects.
Yeah, good.
And the power aspect is not only the template. The power aspect is your twist on it. So you have a description that says what your power template does.
Yeah.
And you don't have to model that through stunts. You don't have to buy flight. You don't have to buy the ability to be Aquaman. You would simply say, okay, you can fly using your athleticism skill just like you do other movement skills.
Yes.
And so forth. And so it's much more built into the description of your character, and then you use stunts to buff it up.
Well, that makes sense because you don't have to worry about balance so much. If everybody can do that, if all the player characters can have an aspect that describes their powers, then that it's sort of self-balancing in a way.
Yes, very much so. The GM, of course, has veto on. He can look at something and just say, "Oh, that's not right."
Yeah,
you can't do that. But that's really the sole balance in there is the negotiation between the GM and the players.
You know, I remember back, did you ever play Over the Edge, Marion?
I have heard of it. It wasn't one I picked up.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's an old game, and it got made into an open license system called Warp. But the reason why I bring it up is that basically you could play any high concept that you wanted, and you would just assign a dice value to it. You know, like, okay, I'm the Archangel Gabriel, 3d6. Or I'm a reincarnation of Leonardo da Vinci, 3d6, and there really is no balancing factor. I mean, you can describe anything in your high concept, and you can do it at 3d6, and it really comes down to whatever the table allows you to do. You know, whatever the other players and the GM are comfortable with, we're fine with.
That's a pretty good description of the way it works in the way that I spun the fake core system. Okay. And, of course, that is really the way the fake core system works. It's some of these others that have tried to bring it tighter from that.
So
as long as you're communicating with the GM to decide what your power level is. So when I say, okay, we're doing street level games, everyone's playing Luke Cage, and some guy goes, yeah, I'm Galactus.
Yeah.
That may throw it out slightly. But, yeah, as long as everyone kind of understands what they're aiming for, it should be okay, yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work out, but it's more like saying there's different power levels, and you could be an Atlas type and fly, or you could be a Luke Cage type and be able to toss a tank across the horizon, but it still gives you the same power level comparatively. So the difficulty ratings are built into it, and they do act as a brake on it. You can't have a character who's Galactus along with a Luke Cage at the same time in the same campaign. It doesn't work.
No, yeah. No, exactly, yeah. Good.
Well, let me ask, has anyone on this call, has anyone played the Daring Comics take on Fate Zippers?
I haven't.
Okay, I've always been curious about that, so maybe we should have honestly, talking about that.
I picked it up from the Kickstarter. I thought it was an interesting thing to follow.
Okay.
They go more towards the itemized powers.
Yep.
So if you're the kind of guy that's comfortable power building off of a list, it's a good one to go with.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah. Now, Marion, have you been talking about film a whole bunch, have you picked up fan castings for some of the characters in your books?
Oh, you mean do I think that a particular character is modeled after Hugh Jackman? Is that what you're saying?
No, do I think that you'd like Hugh Jackman to play one of your characters?
I'd love him to play any of my characters, even the female ones.
You know, he would probably nail it, too. He's so good.
Yes. Yes, he is. No, I've never done a fantasy call list for anybody. I haven't tried to take it that far, and if it ever did go that far, it would probably be a movie 10 years from now, and everybody would have aged out of their category and into another one.
Right.
Now, when you're playing in your play tests, did you have we've been talking about these characters, and pretty much everybody on the call is a comics fan, and we can see different archetypes across the spectrum, and you know we've worked very closely with Jason, who's penned the definitive archetype books both on both sides of the aisle, and is your game good for crafting those archetypes? Or have you seen new archetypes come up as a result of the rule set?
Well, the rules are intended to be open-ended, but I do give 12 templates in the rule books that do address those common archetypes. So you have what's called an Atlas type, which is your Superman archetype. You have your Ajax archetype, which is like your Power Man or your Thing archetype. You've got your mentalist, your projector, you know, anybody who shoots stuff. You've got your metamorph. So yes, I do give 12 solid archetypes with a lot of variety inside them so people could tailor them.
I hear champion's vocabulary coming from you, Marion.
That's because even though I never played Champions, I do have, or at one time I had probably a dozen of their books on my shelf.
Yep, yep. A lot of those words, like the energy projector and the mentalist and all those things, those were all first from Champions archetypes.
Yeah. That's right. I can't actually have many new concepts as far as a name is concerned,
yeah,
other than the ones that I named after the characters, like the Atlas type.
Well, I'm not complaining. Champions is a great old game.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there is really nothing original under the sun. It's all, we're all playing with the same palette of colors now.
Yeah.
We're just mixing them in different ways.
That's right. That's
right. So, I think the idea of an energy projector called Shooty Death Man archetype wouldn't probably work as well, so...
You can make an energy projector who shot dolphins, you know? I mean, it's the description is up to you, you know?
Have you had the energy projecting dolphin shooter in your game?
No, but I think it might be just a matter of time. I try and keep it realistic, but one of the things that I did, which is kind of experimental, is in this Kickstarter, I threw open about 80 slots for anybody who wanted to actually write up their character, square it with the rules, and then run it past me as a censor to get it into my universe. And so the source book that's come out of this, the game book is done. It's going to be released as a PDF very shortly. And all of the backers who picked up the game already have the game PDF as a pre-release. But the source book is probably going to take until June or July, because it's going to be just a mega book of characters, and only about 20 of them are from the books. All of the rest of these are people who have read my books, who want to play in my world, and the condition has basically been, okay, you run the power by me, you run the character by me, and I'll vet it and help you put them in. And I even put in the character agreement that if I decide to use them in my future stories, I get that right.
So, nice.
Yeah, so I can bring in a jester that somebody created or something like that and kill them off horribly, and they can't complain.
So is that Barlow's Guide to Superhumans?
There are a few that are putting villains in it. There's some that are putting superhuman civilians in it. There are a few. A lot of them are doing your standard type superhero, but there's a lot of imagination out there. I've really been impressed by where people have been taking the system and taking their thoughts about the world.
Oh, cool. Just to give you some context to Walt's earlier comment, Jason's written a couple books. Supervillain Handbook was the most recent one, kind of cataloging supervillain archetypes. And before, I guess it was the Field Guide to Superheroes.
That's right.
Icons.
Yeah, that's right. Field Guide to Superheroes. And that was from Vigilance Press, and then ours, of course, from Fading Goat.
Yeah. I'm still waiting on somebody to pen the definitive.
What's that, Mary?
That superhero one, or that supervillain one, I think I participated in that, didn't I?
Oh, good.
Doesn't that happen?
Oh, did you?
I think his butt kicked on the cover. Or Atlas. Is that the one?
Oh, is that yours? Is that the red, white, and blue guy? Is Atlas?
Yeah, I think so. Let me see. I've got the paperback of it here somewhere.
Oh, my God. This is awesome.
That's good. I didn't know. Well, I'm deeply flattered. That's wonderful. I had no idea that you got one of the cover pieces. That's great. That's great.
And since it was the villain one, of course, and he's the hero, he was getting his butt kicked by somebody.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's our Nazi villain.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm so glad. Well, now I have to buy your book. Like, now I have no choice.
Worlds collide. Calamity. All right.
Okay, go on Amazon.com, and you can get the first 13 chapters for free in what's called Wearing the Cape, the Beginning. And so that way you can test it out without plopping any money down.
Done. I need a new book to read. Done.
There you go.
Yeah, was that Amazon.com?
I think I've got every Wearing the Cape already on my Amazon wish list, just waiting for a nice commission bonus to come in to actually purchase all those.
So how many game creators are actually on this podcast? How many of you have taken part in building a game?
I think each and every one of us.
All of us, yeah, I think so.
You've entered the dark heart of geekdom here. Sorry, man.
Oh my, I had not realized where I'd wandered. what's been your funnest experience as far as that's concerned?
Say
what system has worked well for you guys?
As far as enjoyability of playing or success publishing, or how do you mean?
Probably both. But what was the fun? Where did you have the most fun building?
Jason, you want to take that one?
Well, it's very interesting because when I first started to do stuff for ICOM, I kind of had a very dim view of the system. It seems to me to be too simple, and it didn't have enough complexity or crunch in it. But as I was working on it, Steve Kenson started to put out all of these supplements for the book. First, it was Great Power, and then Icons A to Z. And it was great to see him show that the system was actually a lot more powerful than I thought it was. And it really, he made an Icons lover out of me, which I did not expect. So that was a very interesting experience.
That is interesting. I looked at Icon when I was shopping around, and I ditched it for Fate, to tell you the truth, because I felt that Fate was much more open-ended. So
yeah,
it's no idea more versatile than I thought it was.
Well, the systems are very similar, especially now. Icons went through a revision, the assembled edition, and it got closer to Fate when it did that. It still has some things Fate doesn't have, like basically hit points. It has a hit point system. But mm-hmm. in general, it's much closer to Fate, and it even has optional rules to ditch the stuff that's not like Fate and put the Fate stuff back in. So it converted me. But I work with – I don't like to make my own game systems. I much prefer to find systems that are out there and tinker with them and see what games fit well with them. So I've had a lot of fun with Fate, but it would be hard for me to run a superhero game and not use Icons now, which I would never have said 2 years ago.
So you're not going to pick up my game then? Okay.
No. That's not. I love Fate. Believe me, I love Fate.
Yeah, no, I usually describe Fate to people. Sorry, Icons as sort of a fusion of Fate and Phase Rip. I kind of call it a gateway drug to Fate because it's Fate, if you're coming to it, especially if you're not coming into Fate Core, you know, maybe if you come to it to Dresden Files or Spirit of the Century, it can be a little ornate.
Yep.
Icons kind of simplifies some of those concepts, makes them more accessible. And we got Walt Rebilliard on, as usual, so we really should mention the Supers Revised Edition that Walt is the publisher of, which we have been doing occasional actual plays here on the podcast. We're doing one tomorrow, and that's another simpler rules-light superhero game that's a whole lot of fun, so... Just wanted to name check that. We would be amazed if we did not name check.
I love you, Mike.
I love you too, Walt. So, well, we're coming up on 3 o'clock. Do we want to go ahead and wrap things up, guys?
Wrap it up. Final thoughts?
I do have one offer for you guys. If you are interested then and you're in the market for playing or play testing a superhero genre game, I do have that pre-release that I'd be happy to pass around through Mike, if you guys are interested.
Oh, I'm in.
Right on.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm sorry, Mike, go ahead.
Is there any chance we get you to run a short demo for us?
I haven't actually actively refereed a game in probably over a decade. So I would have to blow off some serious rust from the barrel. Before I would do anything like that, it would not be live broadcast.
Okay, no worries. You'll be surprised how often I get that response from my game writers.
We get too busy writing to play. It kind of sucks.
Yeah. But yeah, I would totally be up for that if you want to send us the pre-release.
Okay. I'll let Mike know where it's available, and he can forward it to you guys.
Yes, please. I can't wait to see it.
Excellent. And once again, that's Wearing the Cape, the RPG PDF, I assume, is coming soon to one bookshelf, like RPG Now and Drive-Thru.
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. Absolutely.
And you can pick up the series of novels. Amazon's the best place for that?
Yes. And they're available both on electronic book and in paperback. So if you want it on your shelf, it's there.
Okay. Sounds good. Abe, Jacob, Jason, Walt, any closing thoughts?
Do you want to talk about the giveaway from the other day?
I got a feeble memory, man. Refresh me. What are we talking about? I can't hear you, Walt. What?
I'm sorry, masks. We were talking about doing a giveaway for masks.
That podcast hasn't aired yet.
Oh, well, then I guess you shouldn't talk about it.
Yeah, it's been on YouTube, but not on the podcast site. This is behind the scenes stuff. Don't look at the man behind the curtain.
Spooky time travel.
Spooky time travel. That's the problem having a backlog of episodes. So, all right. Anything else, folks?
All good.
I think we're done.
All right. Hey, thanks everyone for coming out. And listeners, thanks for tuning in to the Banff podcast. We will catch you next time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.